Good afternoon. Yesterday I had a couple of complaints that some of the folks in the back couldn't hear me. So if I wiggle out of this microphone or you have any trouble hearing what I have to say, please jump up and down and wave your arms and catch my attention, and we'll try to make sure you all hear me today. I've got some important things to share with you today. I hope you all brought notebooks. Did everybody bring notebooks? All right, very good. The first thing I want you to make a note of is the website address that's up in front of you here. A couple of reasons for that. I'm going to share some things with you today that have allowed me and many others that I've consulted with to have excellent success in our gardens. And I don't want you to miss out on the opportunity for that excellent success. But I've got to present about 4 hours of information to you in an hour and 15 minutes today. And I know that it's after lunch and our minds are a little tired and you may not be able to catch it all. So if you don't, we have opportunities for training programs that you can look over on the website. Also, later this fall, Nick Meisner of Mountain Media Ministries will be coming and doing some filming, and we're actually going to produce some DVDs this fall to try to help, too, with getting some of this information to you folks, because what we have to share, I think, is really vitally important. All of us want to have the greatest success for our efforts in the garden, right? I know I'm basically, I work like crazy, but I'm lazy. And I want every action I take and every step I take in the garden to be fruitful. I want to get the best return for my effort and my investment that I possibly can. So, in order to do that, I have to take some steps to apply what Ellen White called the best science to agriculture. Now, one of the things that I have learned in my career is that there are as many different methods of growing crops as there are people that grow them. And you can go down to the bookstore and find any number of different articles about how to produce crops. Is this microphone causing us trouble here? Okay. You can find any number of articles about different methods for growing crops. My particular experience has taught me that rather than using a method that's driven by a recipe, add 4 parts of calcium, 3 parts of nitrogen, 5 parts of seaweed, and stir it up and say a few words and spread it on your garden and you'll get certain results, I don't subscribe to that method because all of us face different conditions and different circumstances in our gardens. I was trained as a scientist and I bring a scientific perspective to my gardening, and that means that what I tell you will work 100% of the time, not just 99.9% of the time, but unless it works 100% of the time, then it's not valid scientifically. We also have the advantage of understanding what the Bible instructs us about as far as agriculture and what the spirit of prophecy has to tell us about agriculture. And when we work with scientific principles within the guidelines of the Bible and the spirit of prophecy, we will have not just good results, brothers and sisters, but marvelous results. And this is what I try to share in our training programs at Berea Gardens. I want to read a quotation from you here. This is from Ellen White. There is a science in plowing properly and at the right times. Farming has been pronounced unprofitable. People say that the soil does not pay for the labor expended upon it, and they bemoan the hard fate of those who till the soil. But should persons of proper ability take hold of this line of employment and make a study of the soil and learn how to plant, to cultivate, and to gather in the harvest, more encouraging results might be seen. Their plowshares should cut deeper, broader furrows, and they need to learn that in tilling the soil, they need not become common and coarse in their natures. Let them learn to put in the seed in its season, to give attention to vegetation, and to follow the plan that God has devised. That's my choice. That's what I choose to do. And in that process, I try to apply the best science to what I have to teach. Yes? I'll have to get the reference for you a little bit later. All right. Now, a gentleman just asked me a few moments ago, what kind of fertilizer should I use? I wasn't able to give him an answer. And part of the reason that I'm not able to give him an answer is because there are so many different circumstances. We, in this country, have virtually thousands of different types of soil. Soils vary tremendously. And today what I'm going to talk to you about is soil specifically. And I'm going to give you the one single most important key before the end of the day to having success in your soils. This map that you see up here is a map of the dominant soil orders in the United States. And each color represents about anywhere from 100 to 300 different types of soil. Soil is tremendously varied. The chemical properties of soil vary tremendously from one area to another. I have a farm over in Menorah. We have about 124 acres. I have no less than 7 distinctly different soil types on that farm. So understanding our soil is important. And there's not one single recipe that's going to work for all of these soil conditions. We have to understand first what soil is, what our chemistry of our soil is, and then how best to enhance that chemistry to the advantage of growing plants. First of all, I want to tell you what soil is. Most of us go out there and we think, well, dirt is soil. Dirt, to me, is a dirty word. Dirt implies soil that's in an inappropriate place, like under your fingernails or on the collar of your shirt. I don't call it dirt. I call it soil, because the Lord provided this to us as a means to derive our sustenance. And soil is made up only 50% of minerals. When we walk around out here on these grassy areas, most of you don't realize that almost a quarter of what you're walking on is actually air. And there's also about 23 to 25% moisture in those soils, and then the balance, anywhere typically from 3 to 5%, is organic matter. That's what makes up the soil. The soil provides an environment, a dynamic environment for all kinds of different life forms. And what I'm going to share with you today is how to balance the chemistry of this soil in a way that will promote the greatest diversity of those life forms in the soil, and by doing such can provide the greatest nutrition to our plants. Soils have what we call a profile. As we go deeper down into the soil, we have different characteristics within that soil profile. On the very surface of the soil, we have lots of organic matter and typically growing things like sod or forest or other things. The A horizon of the soil is typically what we call topsoil, and this can vary anywhere from a few inches deep to a few feet deep. Here in West Virginia, these topsoils are typically a few inches to about a foot deep. That's where most of the organic activity in the soil takes place. Below that is what we call the B horizon, or some folks call it a subsoil. Some of the root systems of the crops that we grow do extend into that B horizon. And below that, the C horizon is primarily the parent material of the soil. Now, it's important, especially if you're looking for land, to know what these soil profiles are. If you're looking for a piece of property, for example, where you want to establish an orchard, you're going to need a pretty deep A profile in order to support that orchard. And you can't always tell that looking at the surface. So I advise everybody that's looking for land to always carry a shovel in their car. All right? This little diagram here kind of outlines and expresses what we're talking about when we say that there's air and water and so on in the soil. We've got the mineral particles here. We've got colonies of bacteria and fungi. We've got all kinds of organic matter here, and I'm going to give you a definition of organic matter pretty soon that is nice and simple and easy for us to remember. And we've got pore space in these areas that contain both air and water. Now, I'm going to say right up front that the number one problem I have experienced over the course of my career with people that have had challenges with crops is that they don't realize how much air plants need in the root zone. And oftentimes, people that are struggling with their gardens are struggling because they are watering too much. That's a far more common problem than not watering enough. If you don't have air in that root zone, if you take that portion of air and you saturate it and fill those pore spaces with water, you're going to have trouble growing crops. There's no question about that. One of the important characteristics of our soil is what we call soil texture. And soil texture is basically only a description of the size of the mineral particles in the soil. That's all these terms mean. And when we say that we have a clay soil, what we're really saying is that we have a soil that has a very, very tiny particle size. Now, as you look at this diagram up here, this is actually drawn to scale. And this whole thing here is our sand particle. A silt particle is much smaller than the sand particle, and a clay particle is really tiny compared to the sand particle. That's an important consideration in understanding how we need to go about fertilizing our soils and caring for our soils as we grow crops in them. Each of these soil particles has a slight negative electrical charge, and that is going to come into play very importantly, as we're going to see here in a few minutes. Now, the The Agricultural Extension Service has put out, the USDA has put out what we call this soil triangle, and this basically gives us a name or a description of various different ratios of these sand, silt, and clay particles in our soil. And this is how we come up with terms like loam and clay loam. When we say that we have a loam soil, it does not indicate that our soil is productive or that it's nutritious. It simply means that we have a balance of sand, silt, and clay-sized particles. Each corner of this triangle is 100% of each of those particles. Here we have 100% silt, 100% sand, 100% clay at the top, and the various combinations of these determine what type of a soil we have, what our soil classification is. And generally speaking, the most productive soils are right in this area of the triangle here, from a clay loam down to a silt loam soil. We want soils that have clay in them for optimum production. One of the most common comments I hear when I talk to people, especially in this part of the country, is they're bemoaning the fact that their soil has so much clay in it. And when they tell me that, I say, great, you can go good stuff with that. Because clay actually has the capacity to be a far more nutritious soil than a sandy soil or a silt loam soil. I'll explain why in a few minutes here. Now, we talk a lot about organic matter in soil, and we need kind of a definition of what that organic matter is. In chemistry, an organic molecule is any molecule that contains the atom carbon. But when we apply this term to agriculture, we're really describing something a little bit different. And that is that we're talking about anything that is living or was living. That's the simplest definition for what we mean when we talk about organic matter in our soils. Anything that is living or was living. And we've got a few different examples of that. This includes plant roots, both dead and alive, insects, arthropods, bacteria, fungi, algae, detritus or decomposing plant parts, animal waste, and animal byproducts. These are all portions of what we call organic matter in the soil. And the constituents of most of this organic matter are the things on the bottom row there. Sugars, starches, proteins, cellulose, lignins, fats, and waxes. Now, these things play a very important role in the soil because as this soil organic matter breaks down, it improves the soil structure, it improves the aeration of the soil, it improves water penetration, it helps to balance the soil chemistry in a way that allows for the prevention of dramatic swings in pH, that's the buffering capacity that's listed there. It increases something called the cation exchange capacity. Anybody heard that term before? Come on, some of you have been in my class. I want to see some hands up. Okay, we'll describe to you what that is. That's a very important facet of our soil's potential for fertility, and I will explain to you what that is and how we make use of it. And that organic matter also provides nutrients for plants and for microbes. One of the very important things that we want to keep in mind in growing our gardens and growing our crops is that not only are we trying to feed the plants, We want a large biological diversity in that soil that is very, very active. We want lots of bacteria. We want lots of fungi. We want lots of algae. We want to stimulate the environment of the soil in a way that will provide for a tremendous proliferation of all of this biological matter. Why is that? It's because as that bacteria feeds and breaks down other dead sources of organic matter, chemical compounds are formed, nutrients are released into the soil solution that the plants can take up and make use of. It keeps a very vigorous and viable balance of chemistry in the soil that is critical to having really good success in our gardens. So we want to make sure that we have plenty of nutrition, not only for our plants in the soil, but for all of those other microorganisms as well that are basically small little fertilizer factories for us working in the ground. The periodic table of the elements, a listing of all the chemical elements that we have identified so far, consists of 114 different elements. Some of these are man-made. This particular chart only goes up to 113. That's because they manufactured a new element last year, and there are now 114. I put this up here to help us understand something that really escapes most people that work in agriculture. And that is that of those 114 elements, plants only require 17 of them to flourish. There are 17 essential elements that plants need to flourish. There's an 18th element, cobalt, that they're not sure whether it's an essential element. It does seem to help with plant growth, but you can remove all of the cobalt from the soil media and a plant will still grow. These other 17 elements, if you remove any one of these, plants will not grow. And part of the aim that I have as an agronomist is helping growers determine how to achieve the best balance of all 17 of these elements. Now, I've got a question for you. Plants need 17 elements to grow, and they can grow prolifically with only these 17 elements. How many elements do you and I need to grow? Pardon? Only eight? Eight essential elements is all that we need as human beings? I think it's more along the order of about 50 or 52, that we will not have optimum health unless we have about 52 different elements in our bodies. So, for those of us particularly that are on a plant-based diet, not that it would matter, because even people that are eating livestock are eating typically livestock that graze on plants that only need these 17 elements, where are we getting the other nutrients that we need? For example, we need iodine in our system. We need selenium in our system. Those things are not on this list. If the plants don't need them, where are we getting them? Anybody know? The plant does not manufacture them. You can't manufacture an element. Well, we can in the laboratory, but in nature, elements are not manufactured. They're rearranged and mixed in combinations in various different molecules, but they're not manufactured. Pardon? The body cannot make elements either. Pardon? No. Actually, what happens is that the plant, in the process of absorbing these 17 essential nutrients, actually absorbs some of those other elements that we need for our health, such as the iodine and the selenium, in compounds that are associated with these elements that the plants need. They basically piggyback in with the elements that the plants need. Now, this presents us with an interesting issue. I mentioned a couple of days ago that many of the soils in America, and in fact other parts of the world as well, where agriculture has been practiced for a long time, the soils are becoming very depleted and the nutritional quality of food is plummeting. And part of the reason for that is because typically in large-scale commercial agriculture there are only three nutrients that most farmers are concerned with applying, and that's these three right here: nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Now, even when farmers take the time to address problems with boron or copper or some of the micronutrients, they're still not addressing those issues of iodine, selenium, and the nutrients that we need. So, if we want to grow healthful food, what do we need to do? We need to find a way to incorporate a broader array of nutrients into the soil than what the typical gardening magazines and what typical agricultural scientists are going to tell us to do to grow plants optimally. We can grow plants optimally this way. Hydroponics is based on this. Are you folks familiar with the term hydroponics, where plants are grown basically in a soilless media and they pump water through with all of these nutrients in it in just the perfect balance for the plant? Well, there's a real flaw in that, because there are not the other nutrients that we need in that plant solution. So the plants may grow well, the tomatoes may look nice, but they're not providing us with the nutrition that we need. So what I'm going to describe here today is a method of getting some of these other nutrients into the soil too that we need. But my background and the background of most agronomists and soil scientists is basically confined to the understanding of these 17 nutrients. The first three of these nutrients, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, come from the environment. Plants derive these from both water and carbon dioxide. You're rarely going to find a deficiency of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen in plants unless the plant is severely dehydrated. The next three nutrients are called primary nutrients. That's nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Commercial modern agriculture focuses primarily on these three nutrients for growing plants. And nitrogen, by most standards among commercial growers, is the most important nutrient, because nitrogen is responsible for the production of protein. It is key in the processes of photosynthesis in the plant. And if a plant has a shortage of nitrogen, it will not produce to its ultimate capacity. One of the things that Dr. Borlaug did, you remember Dr. Borlaug from a few days ago, the leader of the Green Revolution, the man that won the Nobel Prize in 1962 for developing plant varieties that responded well to fertilizers. One of his pieces of work was to develop plants that could utilize nitrogen very, very efficiently to produce starch. And that's why I told you a couple of days ago that much of our food today is not as nutritious as it was just a generation or two ago, because it's primarily starch, and the full array of phytochemicals that we need for our nutrition are just not present there. The secondary nutrients are considered to be calcium, magnesium, and sulfur. And in some instances, farmers will address problems with these particular nutrients in the soil. And the most common way of addressing this is typically with applications of either limestone or sulfur to help moderate the pH of the soil. The last group, boron, copper, iron, zinc, and so forth, are considered the micronutrients, and that's because plants use these in very, very tiny amounts. Boron, for example, in the soil is optimum at about 2 parts per million. That's a very, very tiny amount. But if that boron is not present, you're not going to get optimum growth. I have a question. I'll explain all of this, okay? In fact, I'd like to encourage you, I've got a lot of ground to cover today. I'd like to encourage you, if a question pops into your head, just jot it down, and I'll try to take a few minutes at the end today to address your questions. But I may answer them before we get there, and that's one that I will answer. Some of these micronutrients, especially boron and chlorine and copper, can actually become toxic at relatively small amounts too. Boron, for example, as I said, is optimum at about 2 parts per million. At 4 parts per million, it becomes toxic in the soil. So we've got a delicate balance that we want to maintain here, and there is also a balance between these nutrients that we want to try to maintain in a soil. And this is part of the reason why when someone says to me, "What do I fertilize with?" I can't give them an answer without a very important piece of information. And that important piece of information is a soil analysis. This is the very first step that we should take if we are going to be serious about growing quality food in our gardens. Now, people have questioned me from time to time, saying, "Well, you know, when the time of trouble gets here, we're not going to be able to send our soil to a lab. You know, how come we have to rely on this outside source? Can't we just sniff the soil or taste it like our grandparents did and know what the soil needs?" And the answer to that is no, you can't. There's a full array of information on this soil analysis sheet that would take me, with years of experience in diagnosing plant deficiencies and nutrient excesses, to determine what's going on in that soil. It might take me 4 or 5 years just observing the crops growing to know what the chemistry was in that soil, where with a soil analysis, I can send a sample to a laboratory and 4 days later have these results emailed to me, and I've got a very clear picture of what I'm working with. This is a baseline piece of information that you all need, and it's really a very important first step. Well, what about the expense of this? The cost of this soil analysis that's up here in front of you right now is $15. It's cheaper than half the price of a hoe, about a third the price of a bag of fertilizer. So is it worth it? Absolutely. It's the most important and single best investment that you can make in your gardens. Now, I use a laboratory called A&L Eastern Laboratories, located in Richmond, Virginia. That's where this analysis came from. And the reason that I had you write down my web address at the beginning of this session is because the address and contact information for this laboratory is on the website, as is almost everything else that I'll be referring to today. Now, this is an analysis here of two separate samples. Let me get my cursor up here. The sample is reported across the lines on the analysis this way. There's an F1 sample and there's a GH4 sample. So there are actually two analysis results on this sheet. So this was a $30 piece of paper. But it gave me more information in 4 days than I could have acquired in 5 years studying my crop, even with my level of expertise. So I can't stress enough that getting a soil sample is important. Now, how do you do a soil sample? What's the method for taking this? I like to modify the top foot of soil. I like to where I'm going to be gardening intensively, work my soil at least a foot deep. You remember the quotation that I read to you earlier, and there are other quotations where Ellen White counsels us to plow deeply. Well, a foot is deeply. Typically, in America, we consider the plow layer to be about 6 2/3 inches. Why they came up with 6.66, I don't know, but that's what the plow layer is. Hello. That's what the plow layer is in America, is considered 6 2/3 inches. So when we plow a foot deep, we're nearly doubling that. And we don't need to go much deeper than that for most of our crops, because most of our crops are going to derive the bulk of their nutrition in that portion of the soil. There are a few exceptions to that. Things like tomatoes can have a very profound and deep root system. But if you nourish the top foot of soil, you're gonna be very well off. I take and I dig a hole with a shovel, foot deep, and I will take a stainless steel tablespoon with me, and I will collect about 4 tablespoons full of soil from that hole, starting at the bottom of the hole and pulling up through the soil profile, so that I'm sampling everything from about 12 inches deep up to about the top 3 inches. The very top of the soil I don't necessarily want to sample, because remember, that's where all our organic matter was, where all the stuff that's actively growing and living is, and it'll give us a little bit of a skewed result. So the essence of what I'm trying to say basically is that we want to sample from about 2 inches deep down to about 12 inches deep. And we can do that real easily if we take a tablespoon and just pull it up and just peel off some of the soil out of the side of that hole. And if you have a garden that's, say, 50 feet by 50 feet, do that in maybe 4 or 5 places in that garden, so you get what's called a composite sample. And you get a representative of what's in that garden place, and that helps diminish the possibility of taking a soil sample where a bird might have flown over the day before and bombed the soil with a little extra nutrition that may not be present in the rest of the ground. So it gives us a better picture if you take what's called a composite sample. You need about 1 pound of soil, which is amount about the size of my fist. You send that off to the laboratory. You ask for an analysis, and the particular analysis that I have here from A&L Laboratories is an S3 analysis. Now, a lot of us know that the University Extension Service offers a free soil analysis, and I don't make use of that. And part of the reason that I don't make use of that is there's some information that I want to make use of that they don't analyze for. Let's remember that most of the fertilizer industry and the companies that are built around doing soil analysis are catering not to home gardeners but to large-scale commercial agriculture. Okay? It's not unusual for a large-scale farmer, for example, to maybe do 50 or 60 of these soil analysis a year on various different parts of his farm. So that's their constituency, basically. It's not us home gardeners, and it's particularly not us home gardeners that are concerned about growing produce with the maximum amount of nutrition, because frankly, that part of the equation isn't even on their radar screen. So when we send a sample to a lab like WVU, we're not going to get the numbers back that we really need in order to do a thorough analysis and a thorough study of that soil in a way that will build the soil microbiology the way that we want to. All right? A couple of numbers on this soil analysis that are really important to me. And I know some of you are gardeners and you're aware of how important nitrogen is to growing, and that's usually the first thing that someone looks at when they look at a soil analysis is how much nitrogen do I have there? Well, if you'll notice, I haven't even asked for an analysis of nitrogen on my soil because frankly, I don't care. Other numbers on this list are far more important to me than the nitrogen, and that has to do with this part. Let me get my cursor up here. This part of the analysis right down here where it says percent base saturation. And I'm going to walk you through some steps today. You may not be able to digest it all. If you can't, get the recording that they're doing here or visit my website or look for some further training. But I'm going to tell you that this is the key to growing high-quality, nutrition-dense produce, is getting this base saturation where you want it to be. And I'm going to talk to you about how to do that when I continue here. I want to take a few minutes and talk about sources of plant nutrients, things that we can use on the ground to help enhance plant nutrition. And for things that are nourished according to USDA organic standards, they must be one of these things: animal wastes, animal byproducts, things like blood, horn, and hoof meal, crop residues, cover crops, composts, seaweeds, and mined minerals, some mined minerals. These things are all on that OMRI list that I was telling you about the other day, and are certified for nourishing crops organically. Now, do you see anything on this list that might cause us a little trouble? I see a lot of things on this list that cause me some trouble. And for this reason, even though I am a certified organic grower, I have to tell you that I disagree with organic standards on this point of how we nourish plants. Part of the reason I disagree with this is because, especially if you're growing on the scale that I'm growing, if you have 3 to 5 acres of organic crops, it's a very difficult task to find sufficient sources of material to nourish those crops unless you use animal wastes or animal byproducts, manures and other byproducts. And frankly, the sources for the quantities that I would need in order to accomplish that are likely going to be confined animal feeding operations, where animals are held in close quarters, where they're heavily medicated with antibiotics, growth hormones, and other medications that actually come through that manure and can be picked up by the plants and fed to me when I eat those plants. So I do not consider that type of fertilizer safe. And this includes the bags of steer manure that you'll find on the shelves of Walmart this time of year. Now, I'm not saying don't use manure. I'm saying you have to have an awareness for the source of manure that you are using. If you've got a neighbor that's got a horse and a couple of goats and they're just out grazing in the pasture and they're not medicated and there's nothing in their diet that is going to present a hazard to you, then by all means, make use of it. But the reality is, for those of us that are growing commercially, we can't find the quantities of that kind of material unless we're using one of these sources. And that, to me, is a problem. I do use cover crops, and I do use crop residues. I use a lot of composts. I use some sea-based items. I use a sea salt rather than seaweeds, and I do use mined minerals. And at this point in time, the reason that I am certified organic is because we're new in the area. This is only our second growing season in the marketplace. And when I approach people at a restaurant or a small market and I want them to buy my produce, if I have that little seal, that certified naturally grown seal, it gets my foot in the door. And it allows me to have a little credibility with those folks. But my intention is, over time, to educate them on these issues and help them understand that that is not necessarily the safest and best way to go. And at that point in time, I may or may not drop my organic certification so that I can make use of some other materials that I consider to be safer than these, which right now the organic program does not allow me to use. One of the bases for my nitrogen aspect of fertilizing my crops has to do with a family of plants called legumes. Legumes are things like alfalfa, clover, vetch, peas, and beans. And these particular plants live in a symbiotic relationship with a bacteria called rhizobia. Rhizobia have the capacity of taking atmospheric nitrogen and fixing it in the root zone in a way that plants can use. Plants need lots and lots of nitrogen. Unfortunately, even though there is about 80% nitrogen in this atmosphere that you and I are breathing in right now, it's in a form that plants can't make use of. This particular family of plants, in combination with this rhizobia bacteria, is a method of taking atmospheric nitrogen and getting it into the root zone so that plants can use it. So this is one of the primary ways that I make use of for fertilizing my crops. And this is my fertilizer crop right here with my daughter and our two dogs. But this red clover that you see in this picture is what I use to apply nitrogen to my soil. I plant it in the fall. I till it in the spring just before I'm ready to plant my crops. And it provides me with an adequate amount of nitrogen for growing my crops. Now, that doesn't provide sufficient nitrogen for all the crops that I grow, so I still have to make use of composts and some other things to help nourish my crops, but it's a very effective way for using a natural system, a plant-based system, to provide nutrients to my soil rather than using manures. Excuse me. All right. Among organic growers, synthetic plant fertilizers are verboten. And it's a dirty word to say commercial fertilizer if you're an organic grower. And I have a little problem with that. I worked for about 30 years selling commercial fertilizers to growers, and I know that many of them are perfectly safe. Perfectly safe. But there are some that are not perfectly safe. And when I say they're perfectly safe, they're only perfectly safe if they're used in the right proportions, in the right amounts. Commercial fertilizers are very, very powerful. And the biggest complaint about the use of commercial fertilizers is that it damages soil microbiology. And indeed it will if you're not using them properly. But most of us, when we think of commercial synthetic fertilizers, we think of things like pesticides. These things all come from some mysterious chemical plant out there, and there must be harmful things in there. That's not always true. It's not always true. There are some fertilizer compounds that are actually very simple compounds without any toxicity whatsoever. And a good example of that happens to be the most prevalent nitrogen fertilizer, which is urea. Urea, in the form of a bagged fertilizer, is 46% nitrogen. It's very powerful stuff. But it's actually made from atmospheric nitrogen. It's associated with oil companies because tremendous amounts of energy are required in order to take that atmospheric nitrogen and combine it with hydrogen to form a molecule. And that molecule initially is ammonia, which is then converted to urea. But the constituents that are actually in the bag are simply atmospheric constituents. This is not a hazardous material. It can be hazardous in how it's used because it's very potent. Again, this is why a soil analysis is so important. Phosphorus, potassium, sulfur, many of these things are simply mined minerals that are in the fertilizer bag. There's nothing dangerous about them. What is dangerous is how they are overused. Nitrogen is probably the single biggest example of that, because in commercial agriculture, one of the last things growers want to do is to run short on nitrogen, so they tend to overapply it pretty dramatically. And when they overapply it, particularly in the form of ammonia, it sterilizes the soil, it kills off the soil microbiology, it raises the salt index of the soil, and it leaves residual nitrogen there that is carried off into either the groundwater or surface water and causes pollution issues. But if it's used properly and appropriately, it can be a perfectly sound ingredient to make use of. And I say this because when we first establish our gardens, one of the things that I like to encourage people to do is to build a reservoir of nutrition in your soil. And this initial building of the reservoir of nutrition in your soil may require dramatically more inputs than it will to maintain that reservoir once you start growing crops in it. And in some instances, making applications with some of these materials can be justifiable and sensible. Now, there are many commercial fertilizers that I do not suggest that you use, and I'll get to a list of which ones I think are okay and not okay. Anything that is a refining byproduct, sulfur in some instances is a refining byproduct, and many of the additives in blended fertilizers like triple 10 or 15-5-10 that we have here are hazardous materials. I don't agree with using those. Those are, to me, totally unsafe. But simple chemical compounds that we find in a bag, phosphoric acid, potassium sulfate, the limestone that we use or gypsum that we use for calcium and magnesium, those things can be used perfectly safely. When we look at a bag of fertilizer, there's usually three numbers on it. And those three numbers indicate the amount of available nitrogen, available potash or potassium, and available phosphate. Anything that is a blended fertilizer, which means that there is more than one constituent in that bag, to me is a red flag, because it indicates that there are probably some hazardous materials in that bag too. Because of recent legislation at the federal level, it's actually now legal to use fertilizer as a mechanism for disposing of some hazardous wastes. What the EPA determined was that it's far safer to put a little bit of toxic stuff everywhere than it is to leave it all piled up in one place. And as a result of that, many of our blended fertilizers contain heavy metals. They contain many other compounds that would otherwise be considered a hazardous waste. It's being used as a disposal system for hazardous waste. So if you're using 10-10-10 in your garden now, and when I go to the farmer's market or go to the farm store here, the Southern States Co-op, that's usually all you see in this area is 10-10-10. That's not the stuff that you want to use. Stay away from it. I'm going to give you a list of things that are safe to use if you choose to use them. If you have capacity to use other materials, that's just fine. My preference, though, when it comes to safety, is to avoid animal products. Simply avoid animal products. There are ways that we can nourish our crops differently. Okay? Now, one of the other aspects of our soil analysis that's very important is the pH range. pH is basically a measure of the acidity or the alkalinity of the soil, and it's actually a measurement of two different types of ions. Hydrogen ions if it's an acidic soil, hydroxyl ions if it's a basic or an alkaline soil. And the range for plant growth, you can see here, is really pretty narrow. On this pH scale, this is a logarithmic scale. That means that a pH of 4 is 10 times as acidic as a pH of 5, and that a pH of 5 is 10 times as acidic as a pH of 6, so that 4 is 100 times more acidic than 6. This scale goes up very dramatically either way when you get away from neutral. The scale goes from 0 to 14, 7 is neutral, and the range for plant growth on the planet is from about 4.5 up to about 8.2. That's where most plants grow. There are a few exceptions to that, but not very many of them. In our gardens, we want to maintain a pH that's pretty close to neutral, between about 6.5 and 7. this is a very important aspect of how to get good productivity out of our gardens, because when we look at the effect of pH on many of the nutrients that we have on our list of elements that plants need from the soil, between 6.5 and 7, we have the greatest availability of these nutrients. Each of these lines indicates the relative availability of a given amount of nutrients. And you can see as we go lower in pH here, for example, that phosphorus becomes less and less available on both sides of neutral, and many of our micronutrients become much less available at a high pH. So balancing the pH is a very important first step in getting our soils to be very productive. Here in the east, I showed you that map of dominant soil orders when we first started here. In the eastern United States, almost all of our soils are acidic. We have lots of problems with calcium deficiency, and our soils are pretty acidic. These pH adjustments are relatively easy to make. We apply essentially just elemental sulfur to lower the pH of alkaline soils. And if any of you are from out in the western states, this is more of a practice that you would encounter out there than here. But here in the east, we use limestone a lot on our gardens. But unfortunately, most of us have no idea how to calculate the optimum amount of limestone to put on our soil to get the given pH. I was working with one of my friends at the farmer's market who knew that it was important to lime her soil, and she asked me to analyze it for her, so I took a sample and I sent it to a laboratory, and it came back and her pH was about 8.5, because she'd been out there putting lime on every year, not really knowing what she was doing, and she overdid it to the point where now she's having problems growing things. And while I mention that too, I want to clarify that when I talk about doing a soil analysis, send it to a reputable laboratory. There are lots of kits that are sold and some nurseries for, you know, do-it-yourself home soil analysis stuff. Stay away from those, because I've not encountered in all of my years of experience any of those that are consistently accurate. The equipment that they have at A&L Laboratories, for example, is multi-million dollar flame spectrometers that can pin things down to parts per billion. And with a home soil test kit that consists of a few test tubes and some bottles with reagent in it, all those reagents have a shelf life. Your opportunity for error is very, very high, and I do not recommend the use of home soil test kits while we have these laboratories available to us. But the limestone amount that is in the soil needs to be carefully determined. I want to talk for a little bit about some of the electrical aspects of the soil that are important, and then I'm going to get to the real meat of what I have to share with you today. I know I'm pouring a lot of information at you, but I really want to give you the key to success in your gardens today. And in order to do that, I've kind of got to throw a whole bunch of stuff out there. Soil has each soil particle, no matter its size, whether it's a grain of sand or a small little particle of clay, has a slight electrical charge, and it's a negative charge. And this is important because this negative charge has the capacity to attract a positively charged ion and attach to it, just like a magnet pulls a negative magnet pole will attract a positive magnet pole. There's a magnetic attraction in the soil between the soil itself and some of these nutrients that were on our list. And this is a really important concept to try to get your mind around. The size of the particles determines how much overall negative charge you have in the soil. Now, let's look at this diagram for a minute. We've got a particle of sand here. I don't know what's easier for you to see, whether I should use this or the other thing. This is easier for me to use, so I'll use that. We have our particle of sand here that has a slight negative charge. Okay? We've got a little tiny particle of clay here that has a slight negative charge. They both have an equal slight negative charge. But when I look at a soil, if I look at my soil triangle and I determine how much clay is in that soil, I can see that if I have this same volume of area that this sand particle occupies, occupied by clay, I have much more negative charge in the soil, correct? Can you all see that? Okay, This is measured in the laboratory, and they assign a term to this called cation exchange capacity, or CEC. This number of CEC gives us an indication of how much nutrition that soil can hold. Okay, you all with me? Nobody's falling asleep today, but you're all looking a little bit stunned. Cations are basically just positively charged ions. And the cations that are in the soil that are of most concern to us in soil science are calcium, magnesium, potassium, hydrogen, and in the case of alkaline soils, sodium. These positively charged cations are attracted to those negatively charged soil particles and actually bond with them and are held together. And the balance of these nutrients is what we find expressed on our soil analysis down here in the percent base saturation. Now, a CEC, again, is simply the measurement of a soil's ability to hold cations. It's a measurement of all those negative sites. The base saturation refers to the quantity of cations absorbed by the soil particles and held by the soil's negative charge. And when we get down to our analysis here, the percent base saturation tells us how much of each of those cations is present on the soil complex, okay? If we zero in on this part of the soil analysis, this is what we're talking about here. My percent base saturation here tells me that when it comes to calcium, for every 100 negative sites in my soil, 48.1 of them have calcium attached to them. All right? 14.5 have magnesium attached to them, and 2.9 have potassium attached to them. 34 of them have hydrogen attached to them. And remember, our pH scale is a measurement of hydrogen or hydroxyl ions. This indicates that I have an acidic soil. And if I look at my pH, indeed I do. My pH on this particular sample is 5.2. Now, is that where I want it to be? No, it's not. One of the ways that I can eliminate that hydrogen and neutralize the pH is by adding limestone to the soil, correct? But I need to know how much to add. And there's something else about this aspect of the soil analysis that is critically important. Critically important. You will not learn this at a land-grant university because, again, this information that I'm about to share with you is based on a perspective of how to build the optimum soil environment for microorganisms. I'm not talking now about calcium, magnesium, and potassium for feeding my plants. I'm talking about calcium, magnesium, and potassium in the soil complex that is balanced in an ideal way to promote the most dynamic biodiversity, if you will, in my soil. Okay? There was a man named William Albrecht that worked for the University of Missouri back in the 1940s, and he did some extensive studies on foraging animals. He was basically a specialist with cattle, and he started looking at cattle and the health of cattle and correlating that with the soil chemistry of the pastures that they were grazing on. And he discovered some very important things that have really been pretty much ignored by the agriculture community, but are very important to us. He discovered that if in this base saturation the percentage of calcium was 68% or higher, the percentage of magnesium was 17 to 20%, and the percentage of potassium was 5%, that there were ideal conditions for good health in the animals that were feeding on these soils. Now, over time, I've applied this in my own experience, not just in my gardens, but with many of the people that I have consulted with over the last 25 years. And I've had excellent results every time we have made an effort to increase the calcium to at least 68% and achieve these levels of magnesium and potassium. The single most important number in agriculture is 68% calcium. If you achieve that, You can have a soil environment that will work very dynamically and will provide the most optimum nutrition from all of the other steps that you take in managing your soil. Now, this is a very different paradigm than most soil scientists work with. Most soil scientists would look at that soil analysis, they would look at the levels of NPK and make considerations and counsel on that. They might address the pH a little bit with a limestone application, but they're not concerned about making sure that this is at that 68% threshold. If you do this and nothing else in your gardens, you will have a dramatic increase in production. I guarantee it, 100% of the time, every time. This is the single most important piece of information that we can get, and the only way we can get this is if we do a soil analysis. Okay, is everybody with me? All right, good. I'm going to throw a little equation at you here now. And I had someone talk to me earlier today about their fear of math. And I'm sorry that I have to tell you that those of us that work in agriculture, we make pretty extensive use of things like algebra and geometry and other things too. And math is important. For all of you young people here, pay attention to your math studies. It's very important in order to do practical things. This equation at the top of this page here, and I'll just repeat it. As it's written here, 0.5 times the CEC times the percent hydrogen tells us how many tons of limestone per acre to add to neutralize the soil, to eliminate all that free hydrogen in the soil. This is the first step that we want to take to neutralize the pH, to bring our pH from 5.2 up to a suitable level of 7 for good production. If we carry this equation to its conclusion here and I plug in the numbers from my soil analysis, I can't remember if I've got a, we'll go back to my soil analysis. My CEC is 11.4. My hydrogen I get from this number down here at 34%. So I plug those numbers into this equation and I find that I need 1.938 tons of limestone per acre. And if I apply that, my hydrogen number in that base saturation is now 0. I have neutralized it. I have used calcium to displace the hydrogen in the soil. Now, I mentioned to you earlier that in soil science, they use the top 6 2/3 inches to determine these calculations, and I want to modify the top foot of soil. So because of that, I will take my answer here and multiply it times 1.8 to determine how many tons of limestone per acre to apply to modify the pH of that soil in the top foot. You see how I did this? Okay, 1.8 is simply extending that from 6 2/3 inches down to 12 inches deep, okay? If I take 1.8 times 6 2/3, I get 12. The other piece of information that we as gardeners need to know is how many square feet there are in an acre. Because if you're not farming an acre, once you get tons per acre, you need to figure out how to break that down to fit your size of garden. I'm going to let you do the math on that, but that's basically just some simple algebra too. Okay? Now, limestone consists of three primary different products. When we go to the farm supply and we say, I want some limestone, we can likely get one of three things. We can get what's called calcitic limestone, which is calcium carbonate, which is 40% calcium. We can get what's called hydrated lime, which is calcium hydroxide, and that's 54% calcium. Or more commonly, we find dolomite lime, which is calcium magnesium carbonate. By adding any of these to the soil, what will happen is that calcium is a cation that has two positive charges. Hydrogen only has one. And if we apply calcium to a soil that has too much hydrogen, because it has a stronger affinity for that negative site on the soil particle, it'll actually push the hydrogen off that site and attach itself. So the calcium displaces the hydrogen that's in our soil. You follow me? All right. Magnesium can do the same thing. And in some instances, as with the sample that we're addressing here, my magnesium is a little bit low too. So in this particular instance, I would make the choice of using dolomite because I can use both calcium and magnesium for that purpose to exchange on those sites. Do you see? Okay, awfully quiet out here today. If you take this step and apply it to your gardens, I can guarantee that you will have good results. Now, one of the things that we've got to look back on now here is that if I apply calcium and I reduce my hydrogen to zero and I've applied purely calcium to do that. I'm not going to confuse you by talking about the magnesium today, but if I reduce this number to zero, what happens to this 34? I've added calcium here to replace this, so this number is now zero based on that equation. So 34% of my sites are now occupied by something else, which is calcium, right? Okay, so I can take this number and move it from here to here and add it to the 48 that's already there. And if I do that, do I exceed my baseline of 68%? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Okay, do you see that? Okay, I see a lot of eye rolling out there, and I'm sorry, folks, but gardening is a science. And frankly, if we had been doing our homework for the last 100 years, we wouldn't have so much catch-up to do right now. But I want to give you a taste today for understanding that we do have methods of achieving optimum production. And if you want the best results for your effort, it pays to study and show yourself approved. It's that simple. I can't simplify it any more than this for you. This is actually pretty simple stuff. It's just something that we have not been exposed to before. My desire in our training program is to train you to the point where you can confidently go to others and train them on these things too. In fact, we have some examples of that in folks that have come through our training program. But these are the kinds of steps that are necessary for us to really achieve the optimum benefit from our gardens. If you want to just go out there and do what everybody else is doing and throw a bag of 10-10-10 on, not knowing what you're doing to the soil chemistry and having good crops one year and bad crops the next, you're going to be in the same boat as everybody else. If you want to grow crops with optimum nutrition, you're going to have to work a little bit for it. So that being said, I want to leave you with one other thought here. I'll be back tomorrow, by the way, if you have follow-up on this or you have other questions you want to ask. I want to give you a list. I told you I'd give you a list of things that I consider safe on those list of synthetic fertilizers, and this is the list. It's a pretty short list based on what's available out there, and you may not find all of these things at your local farm supply, but if you ask them for them, they can order them for you. But all of these materials, urea, which is 4600, ammonium nitrate, 3400, calcium nitrate, triple superphosphate, and potassium sulfate, that covers the bases on those three major nutrients that we need to add to our gardens in large amounts. Those are all what I consider to be safe forms of those nutrients. You're not going to get yourself into troubles with any toxicities if you're making use of those. All right, if you want to use horse manure or something like alfalfa hay, you can do that too. And in fact, that's what I make use of in some instances is alfalfa here. But you can see the dramatic difference in the nutrient value of something like horse manure. Okay? Now, all I've been able to do today is really kind of give you a glimpse of some of what's involved in determining how best to approach developing nutrition in your soils. And I know for some of you it's been a little bit confusing. I pray that you will consider what you've seen today. And if you are serious about producing high quality food, either for your family or for a small market garden operation, the larger amount of food that you want to grow, the more important this is, because it brings efficiency to your system. It gives you the best return for your efforts. You remember I was telling you about my 250 square feet of cucumbers last year? Produced 1,100 pounds, 1,100 pounds of cucumbers. I could not have done that if I hadn't gone through these steps. So if you want good success in your gardens, folks, you're going to need to be students for a bit. And for any of you that would like to talk to me afterwards about how maybe you can acquire some of this information, I'd be happy to talk with you about that. Now, I told you I'd give you a few minutes for questions. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left. Are there any questions out there? I knew there'd be a couple of hands. Okay. Yes, and I'll ask you to speak up. I'll repeat your questions so that we don't have to use the microphone.
So if you were going to plant fruit trees, would you use the same thing that you plant today?
If you were going to plant fruit trees, would we use the same thing that we use today? My answer to that is yes. The dominant feeding portion of the root system for fruit trees is actually pretty close to the surface. And although there is wisdom in planting the fruit trees with lots of organic matter in a very large hole, it's outlined from Ellen White's experience at Avondale, it's still advisable to treat the entire area where the orchard is going to be with this. Yes. Yes, sir.
Your alfalfa hay.
Yes.
Typically,
the way I'm going to talk a little bit about a scheme of using alfalfa, but yes, alfalfa hay can be plowed under, but there's really an economic disadvantage to that. The best way to use alfalfa hay is to cut it like you're going to feed it to a cow, and instead of feeding it to the cow, feed it to your garden. Another question here, yes. That all goes into one composite sample. Now, if you have areas of your garden that are dramatically different, sample them separately. But what you're looking to try to find with a soil sample is the general characteristics of any area in the garden that you intend to treat the same. Okay? The ideal time to take a soil sample is in the spring, shortly after the soils have warmed up, or in the fall before they've started to cool down too much. So ideally, perhaps like late March or late September, those are good times. But you can take a sample anytime. And these numbers, especially the ones that we're being attentive to right now on the base saturation, are going to fluctuate very, very little. Some of the other nutrients on the analysis will vary depending on soil temperature and time of year, but these will not vary very much. Yes, sir?
I have two horses, so I have a lot of horse manure to put on our garden.
Uh-huh.
Usually I put it on the fall of the year. Now, you said something about the chemicals in horse manure. Like, we may worm our horses every 2 months.
Yes. In the case of worming your horses, that is such a small amount. That would not be of too much concern to me. But if you're buying manures from a large feeding operation, a poultry house or a dairy or a cattle feedlot, the magnitude of the volume of additives to the food are so much greater. Those are the things I'm saying not to use. No, I wouldn't be that particularly concerned, especially if you're composting the manure before you put it in. Yes, some people do use that practice. It can, yes, if that's done carelessly. And frankly, it's not particularly effective, and it does do some damage to the plants. While we're mentioning that, let me say that anything we treat our plants with, whether it's natural or synthetic, has side effects. Anything. So yes, you can run into problems doing that. I saw a hand back here first. Yes.
How much of the information that you presented today is available on your website?
Not a lot of what I shared today is available on the website. As I said, we do have the training programs, and by God's grace, we'll be able to get some DVDs produced later this fall that we'll be marketing through the website. What I suggest to those of you that are interested in learning more about this is to make sure you have my web address. On the main page of my website, there's a link to sign up for my newsletter. Sign up for my newsletter because you'll get announcements about all those things. I don't have a lot of this information simply posted on the website because, frankly, it requires some explanation, and we've really just kind of touched the surface here today. And without the full picture, you're not going to get the clear picture, if you understand what I mean. So I tend not to do that. Yes? Yes. Yes. I use a turnover plow, and I plow the top layer. I've got an old 1956 Ford tractor, and it's not particularly powerful, so I can't turn a whole foot at one time. But what I do is I turn at least half of it. I get down to that 6 2/3 or 7 inches. I turn that over and I disc it up a little bit, and then I go through a second time, and once the top is fluffy, I can cut in a foot deep and turn the whole thing over. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Back here. Lots and lots of water. Lots and lots of water. Yes. Good question. Initially, I want to clarify something too. When we're dealing with the base saturation, this is usually just a one-time fix. Because once you have those soil particles occupied with the elements that you want and you have that magnetic attraction there, that stuff's not going anywhere. So when I took this soil sample, this was actually taken in an area that was a playground for the last 50 years, and I made a pretty heavy application of limestone to that playground at 1.9-something tons per acre. In the future, I'll never have to add anywhere near that much to maintain the soil chemistry. So this is really kind of a one-time fix. And when you add something to the soil to change the pH, that process takes time. In fact, it'll take about 3 years before I get the full benefit of the limestone that I applied this year or last year. So for my purposes, I won't take another soil sample there until that period of time expires, until about 3 years goes by, and I'll take a sample then just to confirm that I've done what I intended to do. Now, the reality is that if we approach this scientifically and we measure and calculate these things properly, I can predict what the numbers are going to be on that soil analysis. I should be able to sit down and calculate what those numbers will be on the soil analysis. Because we've started with a baseline, we've adjusted that baseline, and everything works from cause to effect if we do it properly. Yes? From a grass area? Yes. Uh-huh. That's exactly what I did with our garden areas, because as I said, we've got our demonstration garden, at least, is in an area that was a playground. And I turned the top of it over with a turnover plow and let it rot down and then disced it up and then turned it over again and started making my amendments. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Okay. I'll take one more question and then I'll have to Yes. A cover crop is something such as the red clover that I showed you that I will plant in the fall, allow to grow through the winter and into the early spring prior to planting my main crop. And when that red clover is about this tall, I'll disc it in, I'll chop it up and disc it into the soil and then plant my crops behind it. That's what I mean by a cover crop. Something that's on the ground through the winter months. All right. Okay, I'd like to thank you for your attention today. I know that it was kind of a heavy dose, But I don't know how to make it any lighter and still give you, an understanding for what the potential is. And if I've just awakened in you an awareness that, hey, there's something here that I can understand that can give me consistently good results if I go through these steps, then I've accomplished something. That's been my desire today. That number 68 with calcium is the single most important thing that I can share with you. The single most important thing. If you get your calcium levels and your base saturation to 68%, you're going to have greater success than you currently have. I can guarantee it. Okay? Thank you for your attention today. Let's have a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, Lord, it's difficult sometimes to get our minds around those things that you have wanted to instruct us for so long. And forgive us, Father, for our ignorance. Forgive us for how we have wandered from the message that your prophet gave to us 100 years ago. As we do our part now to try to catch up and to understand those things that you want us to know, I pray that you'll open our minds and our hearts. Give us the influence of your Holy Spirit, too, to help. As I mentioned yesterday, if we prayerfully approach our gardens, great miracles can happen, as in the example that I cited. Father, abide with us now and dismiss us with your grace. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.